Hello, and welcome to Cool Kids, a show for the insatiably curious. My name is Elise Roy, and on this show, I interview authors, experts, and researchers about what makes them cool. I'm learning alongside you listeners about the journeys of brilliant thinkers. I want to let you know that you're listening to this on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. So today I have on the show my friend and author, Matthew Fan. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you doing today? How's your day going so far?
I'm doing well. It's really nice to be here in the studio with you.
Yeah, it's really nice to just have a conversation with such a talented poet and author and also just a good friend. So you've written 4 poetry books, and that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. How would you kind of describe your style of writing or just yourself as an author?
Yeah, so my life as an author and my life outside of authorship or outside of writing, it's always centered around language and, of course, my life here as a university student. So I study English and geography, and that mix allows me to think critically and playfully about the way words look, language, and how language takes shape in different environments, whether mm-hmm. they be mediatic or just like in the physical, natural environment. So in my work, I like to play a lot with visual poetics, if we can call it that. How would it look like if English as it's written, like the orthography of the English language, is kind of flipped around a little bit? So playful punctuation with rules of grammar, kind of bending the traditional like left-adjusted look of mm-hmm. a poem and mm-hmm. having it words kind of splatter and play around the page and what sort of meanings we can tease out of that.
Mm-hmm. As I've read your work, your poetry does have a really playful aspect with, you know, visually how it looks. You mentioned to me also earlier that you like to explore the place of your words. And can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So two key terms in geography or in geographic thought are place and space. And they get really entangled and intermeshed with each other. And I don't have time to dig into all that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of placement, which is usually like the location of a word, thinking about what language looks like on a page as it's written out and kind of finding a place that feels appropriate in the way that we read words, which is left to right in the English language, but left mm-hmm. to right and then top to bottom. But it's also thinking about space, like kind of giving volume as much as you can, maybe area is a more appropriate word, to thoughts and to language on a page. That kind of goes outside of, you know, traditional grammatic schemes of like, here's a sentence, that's mm-hmm. a period, here's a line break, the stanzas, mm-hmm. like, you know. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten comments that it's rather confusing to read at points, but I think that's kind of the point. Thoughts are messy. Language is, in a lot of ways, an insufficient container for what we're thinking. So my work is trying to see what we can do if we play with the rules and mechanics of language, especially as it's written, and see what, I guess, meanings we can get out of that.
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean there. It's really interesting when I read your work, I feel like it's a manifestation of exactly the thoughts that are coming out of your brain. And mm-hmm. it's a visual representation of that in a way.
Yeah.
So you've written 4 poetry books. These are Midnight Oil, Forever Last, From the Path Already Taken, and Angel in the Night. Can you tell me about when you started writing and maybe a little bit about those books?
Yeah, all right. So the first one in that list is From the Path Already Taken. And that was assembled when I was in grade 8, and it spans most of my middle school years, so from grade 5 all the way to grade 8. And that, it's really just an eclectic collection of like whatever I was thinking of, whatever I was writing. I remember I had a really supportive English teacher in grade 8, and she was like, she was reading some of the poetry I submitted for class, and she's like, oh, this is really good. Have you ever thought about like writing more in a more dedicated manner? Publishing wasn't on the table yet. But I was like, you know, I have like this kind of backlog of works. I used to keep a digital poetry journal on Google Docs. Mm-hmm. And throughout my school days, it was a good way of releasing emotion to some extent. Or just kind of getting out thoughts that I didn't really have anyone else to talk to about in a way. A book came out of that, so to say.
That's incredible. Yeah. I can't believe you've been writing from such an early age. It truly does show. Your work truly is incredible. I want to talk about some of the themes in your work. Can you tell me about the main themes that you normally touch on in your writing?
Oh goodness, this is the scary question for me. A lot of the themes are common to experiences as young adults. So thinking about romance, thinking about love in its sappy ways, but in its more affective ways, it's more even political registers to some extent. So a lot of my more recent poetry has been thinking about relationships and the different tenors that they carry. There's, you know, the Greek classification of different types of love that kind of spills out into different types of relationships that we have and we carry with each other. And part of my project is thinking about going kind of beyond those categories, or what happens when those categories blur or cross, the same way that in your head language is not neatly confined to, like, this is a verb, noun, adjective, we're going to put this in a sentence together, it's going to make entirely sense, right? Our perception of things changes inside in our cognition. It gets mixed up and jumbled. So in that way, thinking about human relationships has been generative towards that. I also write a lot about some of the more, I guess, darker emotions, we might call them. Feelings of sadness or despair, especially in just broader climates that we have going on now, 2024 November, lots has happened and changed. But sort of trying to find one beauty, I think, is a word for that. But also sort of a perfunctory meaning out of those experiences, like those heavy experiences where it's kind of hard to process or to think about, there's still something there. And I think when we try to communicate it in a clear or coherent way, something gets lost. And so I'm trying to bring it back to the more incoherent, the more natural, if you want to call it, state. It's hard. Language is always a mediator, but that's what I try to do, I suppose.
So I do want to talk a little bit more about whether you've had any inspirations in your work so far, whether it's other authors, other poets, or life experiences. Like, how has your experience shaped you as a writer?
Yeah, so the macro scale and kind of corny way of saying it is just people. The people in my life are always directly implicated or inspiring of the poems that I write, especially if my work's about relationships. In terms of authorial style and whatnot, in terms of, like, the visual sense, I take a lot of inspiration from, in the visual arts scene, from Cubist artwork and sculptures, sort of that fragmented capturing of an object or phenomenon from, like, multiple different angles and assembling it together so that it looks really stark and strange and even surrealist to some extent. But I don't know. I love that idea of entangling different perspectives and different almost like half-finished lines of view or lines of thinking. And then one of the poets that I'm inspired by, who is also influenced by Cubism, is E.E. Cummings. I just love the way he plays with words on a page and sounds on a page. And his detractors will say that he was too playful. I don't think so. I think play is, like, one of the more natural states of human creativity.
When you talked about that, you reminded me about how interestingly your work looks on the page. And can you tell me about what playing with punctuation and spacing and all of those elements, how do you use that to your advantage in your work?
Yeah, so this is the part where I get a little bit, like, abstract modernist on you and say, like, it's just by feeling, man. Like, I just sometimes, it's like, as I'm typing it on a computer, even as I'm writing things on a page, I'm just like, you know, this thought would feel so much better represented if there was just, like, a big space here before the period came. Or what if there wasn't even a full stop and it was a comma, a series of comma splices, or playing with punctuation and grammar like that. So part of it is intuition. But it's also just thinking about, I have to think a lot about form, because I'm typing this on a computer and it's going to be printed onto a sheet of paper. So I'm thinking within the confines of, like, a 6-inch by 9-inch page, like, how am I best able to kind of form or configure words on there that might match the sort of cyclical nature of the way I'm thinking, that might match the speed of which I'm thinking, which is to say there's no punctuation, everything's just kind of stream of consciousness flowing, or even the clashing of thoughts that I'm having. And so you'll see that there are a lot of times where words I use get put, like, into each other, like, and it's difficult to sort of tease out what the difference is. And so I use punctuation in those senses to sort of clarify or demarcate where, like, the letters, lettering, the orthography, the sounds separate and diverge from one another, but also to still put all those letters together to form, like, a jumbled word or jumbled words together.
When we first started talking about this, I was thinking about how the use of different spacing and punctuation can convey a stream of consciousness. I find that your words are like a paintbrush, and the page is the page is the paper. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's I'm able to see your thoughts almost leaping onto the page.
ZZ Theatre presents the Rainbow Youth Project, produced by Yanting Chu and curated by Brittany O'Rourke, Alan Pronger, and Bria Shantz. This annual community storytelling project centers the 2S LGBTQ plus voices who often don't get a say in their lives, bodies, and identities. Bringing two-spirit, queer, and trans youth from across Metro Vancouver to share their stories. The Rainbow Storytelling Project is a low-barrier, one-on-one project in which people share true stories from their lives. It is designed to challenge stereotypes and preconceived notions of otherness, promote dialogue, reduce prejudices, and encourage understanding by connecting people who, under normal circumstances, might never meet. The Rainbow Youth Project will be running on dates November 16th, 17th, the 23rd and 24th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Vancouver Public Library Central Branch on the third floor. This is a free event with no sign-up required. All that is necessary is your attendance and your empathy.
But I'm super excited to get into one of your poems. One of my favorite poems that I've read of yours was called Dying to Love You. And I'm wondering if you can maybe tell me a little bit about this poem and if you could read it to us.
Yeah, certainly. So I'll start with a brief, you know, unscripted overview. So this is an interesting note. I think you mentioned sort of the visuality of playing like word language as a paintbrush, and that sort of synesthetic quality, or the merging of different sensorial perceptions, it fascinates me when it comes to poetry, mm-hmm. specifically because of that merging between the visual, the auditory, and here, of course, we're talking on the radio, so we're going to miss that sense of it. But I'm curious to see, and I've actually never really read or performed these poems live, so we'll see how this goes. I'm curious to see if there's a sense of that visual, that paintbrushingness, or that painting with language that's happening as I'm reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So this poem comes from Forever Last, and it's thinking, this one's probably my most explicit one when it comes to thinking through relationships. And it was written about a friend in the time that we were writing our university entrance essays. So this was written in high school, so several years ago, but it got you know, edited and put together for this project here. And so there's an interesting mix of, like, in the moment, the sort of feelings of, like, anxiety and dread you have as, mm-hmm. like, a senior in high school trying to apply for university, but also a sort of, like, nostalgic memory when you're thinking back on it as I'm, mm-hmm. like, going through and editing it, but... I guess I'll read it now.
Yeah, go for it. I'd love to hear it.
So this is Dying to Love You. Confetti fell as scratch paper hearts ripped rippling in the sky, tap dancing on clouded lily pads, nebulous air water surrounding me when I'm with you. I'll miss you always. I'll miss you forever. But then you go and make eternity happen in an instant. Thinking is loud, sea glass rolling to the shore in the sky becoming soft. I cut myself on my own words all the time. Liquid red confetti falling from the sky. Feather flotsam, winged woman, I am dying to love you.
Wow, that's such a beautiful poem. I think one of the parts that first jumped out to me was how the first two stanzas, I believe, of this poem, they have this feeling of lightness to them. Mm. You know, your use of the words confetti and scratch paper hearts, it's just... brings a sense of lightness, and it's immediately juxtaposed by, you know, a very heavy feeling. Maybe you can talk to me about, again, your use of playfulness to create that light feeling in that first part of the poem.
So part of it, again, is the visualness of it. Mm-hmm. This poem kind of zigzags, like mm-hmm. the words zigzag down if you're reading it, looking at it on page. The motion or the movement I'm thinking here is falling. Mm-hmm. What does it look like to fall as confetti from the sky that starts lightly mm-hmm. and then gets taken up by the wind or gets taken into places that are heavier or darker, whatever that case looks like, and that's where the ending mm-hmm. comes in. So the term confetti comes from my friend who was a Girl Scout camp counselor, and her call name, her code name, her secret agent name, I don't know what you call it, was Confetti. And I think that's so accurate to my friend, because she's just so bubbly and so bright and happy all the time. But I'm thinking of starting there, like, as this in the moment where I'm perceiving my friend as, like, you know, this bright, you know, just lovely person, and then thinking about what it means to kind of lose that or say goodbye to that to some extent, within the context of going to different universities, within the context of just growing up, you know? And so it starts playful with the sort of ephemerality of confetti, the sort of, like, discard of scratch paper. Side note, I love scratch paper. Like, if there's paper on the ground, I will pick it up and write on it. And that's where most of these poems come from, in fact. They come from the backside of scratch paper. Just thinking about that movement of this thing that's so... It's not even a thing. Confetti is, like, multiple pieces of strands together, right? That just gets tossed in the air. As a sort of celebration. Like, this is supposed to be a joyous time. And yet, yeah. I can't help but think about the aftermath of it, I suppose.
I was kind of thinking some more as you were talking about what creates this sense of lightness that just struck me when I first read this poem. And I think it's kind of the way that you are not only combining, like, visually how the poem looks, but also with auditorily, when you're reading it out, like, scratch paper hearts, which is one word, ripped rippling in the sky, tap dancing on clouded lily pads. The way you've constructed those words and kind of just thrown them together in a way that is sort of intuitive to you, It really creates this visual, auditory, and just all around feeling of lightness. And I feel like I have this image of in my head of maybe falling through the sky. It's really beautiful. But to talk a little bit about some other themes in your poem, can you tell me a little bit more about what it means, I am dying to love you? That has such weight to it.
And I think that's what I thought when I was really going to close this poem. That phrase to me, dying to do something, that sense of anticipation or that sense of, like, desire or longing, I mean, that's present in the way that we interact with people, I'm sure, right? Like, you're attracted to someone in a romantic sense, in a friendly sense, a platonic sense. There's always going to be that sense of sort of desire, a sort of longing to do something, a sort of dying to do something. I just have to do something. In this case, though, I tried to maybe not invert that thought, but to put it into a register that seems a little bit more eerie or unfamiliar. Like, what does it mean to be dying to love someone? Dying to see someone, sure. Especially if like I mentioned in the poem, like, I'll miss this person forever. Like, I'm dying to see you again. I'm dying to hear from you again. Dying to love you takes on a sort of sinister tone in my head. What is so deathly about love, so to say? And yet, you know, it's instantiated in conventional senses. It's like, you know, to death do us part, right?
I guess that heaviness tied with that feeling of falling really conveys just how intense a feeling of love can be. But I'd love to talk a little bit about one of my other favorite poems from your work. This one is called American Summer. I was wondering if you could introduce this poem to me and tell us what it's about, and then if you could read it to us, that would be amazing.
Sure. So this one is one of my more recent ones. Yeah, so it was written this summer in 2024, and it's sort of the culmination, I would say, of just my summer in general. So I'm originally from the United States. I grew up and lived in California before coming here to UBC. And interestingly, UBC has offered me the longest summer break of my life. Like, 4 months is insane to me. So there's a lot of terrain that was covered during that time. The name American Summer comes both from being an American one, but also because I read a lot of American lit over the summer. Like, stuff that I should have been reading in high school, but because of COVID, I never got around to reading it, or it was, like, taken off the syllabus. So thinking, like, The Scarlet Letter and stuff like that. Gatsby, of course. I love Gatsby. Yeah, I was just thinking about, again, questions of love. Questions about what it means to love in different ways that are beyond sort of clear divisions of, like, I love you as a parent, I love you as a friend, I love you as a romantic partner, I love you as a brother. What happens when all of that gets stirred into one sort of overwhelming, powerful, like, emotion? Even self-love gets put in there, like, you see yourself in someone, sort of thing. And something about that mixedness that heterodoxy, if you want to put it that way, or just that strangeness of love seems American to me in some ways, if you want to put it into a multicultural resonance. And it's also not. We liked very clear-cut sort of perspectives here, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Like in The Scarlet Letter, it's very clear that Hester is bad, or is made out to be bad, not that she's clearly bad. The work of literature is to test that, you know what I mean? To think about, mm-hmm. well, do these categories really hold up, or do these thoughts really hold up? That's a long way of saying that this poem is very complicated. I'm probably going to be stumbling over my words as I'm going through this and trying to explain it to you.
No, it's okay. I've been really excited to talk about this one because there's really just so much to unpack.
Start from somewhere in the middle of the poem here.
Yeah, so. we'll just give you a little snippet of this poem.
It's a long one too. This is from the middle of American Summer. The summer I fell in love with you, I fell in love with everything about you. I fell in love with your fake freckles, your auburn hair, your voice, the slight pause in your breath when you forget something, how your voice pitches when you imitate me, your screaming, your laugh, and your joy. I fell in love with your half-finished dance moves, your quotes and quips and references, your nonsensical humor, the way you tease smiles out of me. I fell in love with the way you look at me, look through me, look past me. I fell in love with the way you forget me, leave me, forgive me. You live your life, and I am only here. But you tap me anyway, half wanting, half wishing me the nothingness you think I deserve. I fell in love with the way you gender me, the way you imagine my love, the way you imagine me, the way you think of me, passingly, unhinged, unanchored. I fell in love with floating somewhere in between your life. I fell in love with the irrationality of falling in love with my best friend. I fell in love with the perpetuity of falling in love with you, of understanding you, of accepting you. You are limitless in my heart, the same infinity that encloses my mourning, grieving, hoping.
Wow, that I really just got chills listening to you read that. I really love this poem. So much to unpack. Love is such a personal and such a delicate thing. One first question I have for you is, do you think that the way that we remember or imagine love can be sort of different from the way that it really was? And how does imagination kind of play a role in this poem for you?
Answer the question one is certainly. I think it's memory certainly does. Time, space, if you want to call it that way, distance, certainly affects the way that we remember our perceptions or even perceive things anew, which I find really interesting because you can think about memory as like just thinking back on or cognitively thinking back on something that happened in the past, or you can think about it as experience it again, just in a different way, in a different time space, like a different modulation of it. And I think that's where the confusing part comes in, because it's like you're seeing it for the first time again, and yet it's already happened to you, and it's not really there in front of you or present.
Mm. So, sorry, just to clarify that a bit, what you're saying is that the memory of falling in love with someone, for example, mm-hmm. exists in that memory, but also in the recreation of it.
Yeah, have you ever tried to, like, remember a dream?
I have.
And, like, try explaining it to someone, it just feels like, this was a dream? Like, this is so weird. Like, why am I even, like, commenting
on
this?
I had a dream last night, and I was trying to remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of like that, because if you just remember the dream in and of itself, you can remember, like, the way of feeling, like, oh, I remember when, like, the spaghetti monster was chasing me down the hall, and I was so scared, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I say that out loud, I'm like, that sounds so stupid. That sounds so silly.
Stupid? I don't think that sounds stupid. I'd be scared of a spaghetti monster too.
Yeah, and then it invites itself into like psychoanalysis. Like, so what does a spaghetti monster mean? You know, but like,
I think it means you want spaghetti.
I think so. I think there's a difference between keeping the memory internal, so to say, and then trying to articulate it. Mm-hmm. And in the act of articulating it, whether that be through a verbal communication or through poetry or through art or whatever that looks like, it reinstantiates the memory, like, in your mm-hmm. psyche or even in your somatic experience, just the way of thinking about it. You're forced to kind of be in that space again, half observer, half spectator, but also, like, part of it again. Like, in the recreation of it, you are creator or you are, playing with it. And I think that's where we're getting at with the whole remembering love escalates it, takes it into a whole different realm.
But I think that our recreation of a memory doesn't necessarily make it any less real, because at least to me, right, our only version of reality is this mess of thoughts that our brain is making. So, you know, whether your brain is perceiving something that's happening for the first time or whether it's kind of reshaping that memory in your brain or even on the page, I don't think that either of those is necessarily the most accurate or
the most real.
Yeah. I think both of those are anything you put into existence with your mind, really, it does have some validity to it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the slippery thing about reality, isn't it? It keeps getting re-evoked over and over again in different ways.
Hi there. You're listening to CADR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC Vancouver campus located on the unceded ancestral and traditional lands of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. We honor the ancestral and ongoing care for this land by the host nations. Media practices are often rooted in white gaze, and we recognize that it is our responsibility to shift our approach and move towards radical empathy. While we broadcast from UBC Vancouver campus, our listenership extends to the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations and beyond. We encourage you to check out native-land.ca, that is native-land.ca, to learn more about whose land and territory you live and work on or may be visiting. Thank you.
Yeah, I think one point where you used the role of imagination in your poem was when you talked about you falling in love with the way you look at me, look through me, look past me, the way you imagine my love, the way you imagine me. We've talked about the role of imagination for yourself, but for you in this poem, what is the role of imagination for this person that you're falling in love with?
Yeah. All perception is imaginative to some extent, or at least the way that perception gets taken up is it leads to a certain imaginary or imaginaries. There's a certain way that this person interacts with me, presents himself with me, engages with me, that I'm constantly making perceptual assumptions about in a very basic way, like, do you like me? Do you hate me? Like that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But also like, oh, do you feel comfortable around me? Do you feel close? Like, do you feel like you can trust me? Then the inverse works as well. So the way that I choose to show or demonstrate love, and writ large love, not just romantic or platonic or whatever, just whatever that looks like in general, connection, relation, the way I choose to show that impacts the other person, this person I'm writing about, and the way they respond to it is an internalized response of how they're assuming that I'm behaving or acting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where these sort of miscommunications can happen, where someone's like, oh, is this person flirting with me? Or is this person like more interested in me than I might be interested in them?
Mm-hmm. You're really touching on points that are so important for, you know, I guess us 20-somethings, people in university. Like, these are things that we're kind of thinking about all the time, hey? All these little nuances of falling in love with someone else or not knowing how they're feeling and just all these tiny gut feelings that we get when we're kind of interacting with another. You describe it really well in this poem. You describe such a special time when you talk about the summer that I fell in love with you. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, you know, what things must be present for two people to fall in love? Like, is it a matter of pure circumstance and the right elements falling into place at the right time? Or do you think it's kind of this magnetic and unstoppable force that's going to happen no matter what? Big question, I know.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that. I'm not sure anyone's qualified to answer that, so let's give it a shot, shall we?
Okay.
But this is one of those moments where I do offer a disclaimer, I suppose, because this entire poem, honestly, can be an exercise in the discourse of delusion, as some people would say. Like, you know, the
the discourse of delusion, I love that.
And you're welcome to call it delusional, but I think there's something else going on here that is related to our perception of reality or recalibration of reality on a constant basis, which is in its own way, like, that is what delusion is, right? It's like it's an uptake of reality in an unfamiliar way that doesn't seem as grounded, but, you know, love is ungrounding, love is unsettling. But returning to your question, I always like the thought that you can do everything right and it still might not work you know, and that's just life. Like, that's not failure. That's not weakness. That's just life. Another way of phrasing that is, like, you can do everything perfectly, but without just a little bit of luck or chance on your side, the spark might not light, sort of thing. I don't mean to sound so fatalistic when I say that, but I do think it's a confluence of you can do so much yourself, but something about the circumstance or the environment has to play with you in a way. Lest we all become our own individual kind of gods, sort of way, and be able to, like, manufacture and create and manipulate everything to our liking. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. And if that is true, then I guess I'm living in someone else's world. You know what I mean? But
yeah, I think a lot of people might have the view that, you know, when pursuing relationships, whether that's romantic or platonic or what have you, that we're our own agents in kind of pursuing this love. But in actuality, we're just riding the wave.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many external factors and things that must fall into place at the right time for things to just click.
That's why you'll notice that in both of these poems that you selected, funnily enough, there are two words here that stick with me. And one is floating, which I think is interesting, that sense of, like, waves and drowning or whatever. But there's a sort of maybe more lightness to floating and what that looks like, but still being taken up by all these forces and whatnot. The other one was tap. I mentioned tap dancing in the first one. I mentioned this person tapping me in certain ways. And that is that those two ideas for me are kind of what it, in my life, at least in my experience, what love feels like. It's like this sort of tapping. I'm glad to say it hasn't been like a gnawing, like clawing at my heart yet. Yet, we'll see. Okay. But it's been a sort of like, it's been a suggestion, like a tap, like a floating. Or at least that's how, in my recording of my reality, I choose to display it as. So
I feel like the word tap is so accurate. I'd never really thought about love in that way before, but it's almost like that feeling that you get when your heart just kind of twitches in a certain way.
Yeah.
Or you get kind of just this inkling deep inside that's kind of inexplainable. And I think that the word tap does do a good job of projecting that. I don't know if I'm interpreting this how you meant.
No, I think so. Something about that sense of it makes itself noticed. Love makes itself noticed in the action of tapping. It can disturb or disrupt if it's repetitive or whatever, but it's not oppressive, I think, is the point I'm trying to get here. I know love can feel that way so often. And I'm trying to think about, in a literary or creative way, how can you reinterpret that into something that's more of an opportunity of connection as opposed to like a dying to love someone, if we want to put it that way.
Maybe the way that we know that, you know, a love is good or true is that if we don't feel that sense of oppressiveness.
And maybe some would say that it's not true, or that it's true in a different way. I don't know, you know?
Knock, knock. Guess who? MRG Live coming right back at you, this time with a whole new list of upcoming live shows by your favorite artists. Hear this. Marika Hackman, Faye Webster, Empress of, Peter Cat Recording Co., and The Rare Occasions are a few of the artists MRG Live is bringing to you. Follow at MRG Live Official on Instagram to stay tuned with all the artists performing near you.
This poem, it sounds like it's really close to your heart. And there are some parts of the poem, I guess, a little bit towards the end, where you kind of allude to this vulnerable place that being in love or falling in love with this person has put you in. It was this last stanza right here. Yeah. If you could read that out for us, I would love that.
So I'll start. This is the last movement, if you want to call it that, of the poem. So this is what marks me more than the books I read. It marks me that I fall in love with something only after realizing someone else has already. It marks me that I desire and dream and get lost in the co-creation of someone else's fantasy. It marks me that I love something so entirely, I destroy something else in the process. Maybe more than anything, I'm afraid of loving too wholly that no one else understands. Maybe I'm afraid that excess is only excess, not simply more. Maybe I'm afraid I'll never know what you want, but I know it will never be me. Still, I thank you, afraid of my own self. Thank you for being someone I can fall in love with, but never will. You take that fear from me, materialize it, you realize it for me, smile. Neither cruel nor calm, you're careless, utterly, hopelessly careless, unabashedly, unwittingly careless, horrifyingly, disgracefully careless, terribly, violently careless, and you'll never care to care. And I am in love with you, this summer and forever. Which is an American love story, I think.
Again, so beautiful, so beautiful. So this is still from your poem American Summer, just to
thank you for that clarification.
Let the listeners know. But that last part, you're talking about this vulnerable place you are in when being in love with this person. One word that really struck me was violently careless. This person that you're in love with is terribly and violently careless. What does that mean?
What does that mean? Oh my goodness. In so many different ways. That's why there's so many adjectives or adverbs there, as it were. Because that sense of carelessness, I think most of us experience it to some extent when we're left with an unreciprocated form of love. Is there another word for that? I feel like I'm missing something. Unrequited. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Unrequited form of love. It leaves you feeling, because you left yourself so vulnerable to that outcome or that possibility, right?
Yeah.
And it sucks. Or it can suck, right?
Yep.
In this case, it's different in different ways. And I'm not sure if it's just the nature of my relationship with this person or if it's me thinking through things a little bit more just differently, I suppose. But there's a part here where I thank this person for being someone I could fall in love with but never will. Like, there's a choice not to, quote-unquote, fall in love with this person. And, I mean, here we're playing with semantics. What's the difference between falling in love with someone and loving someone?
Mm-hmm.
We'd argue that falling in love with someone means that they're also falling in love with you. And it's that feeling of tumult and, like, the classic romance, you know, that sort of love story. But this choice to not or to never fall in love with this person but to love them instead, which in some ways is unilateral, like it's only coming from me. It doesn't matter what the other person responds with, but it is just me loving that person. I think it calibrates that sort of carelessness that I think about. And it's a wonderful and it's a terrible thing to be careless. There's so many different ways I'm teasing at this, so let me continue with the American lit perspective, because there is this distinct, I think there is an American imaginary or American culture of sort of being careless or of not really thinking in the long term and thinking of the here and now, the immediate, the present, the opportunities that are afforded in what is just available to you as it is. And you can intellectualize and critique that from so many angles, whether that be like that's capitalism at it again sort of thing, right? Making you want to stay in the present here and now with the promise of there will be a better tomorrow if you work for it now. You can think about it in terms of like heteronormativity and patriarchy as well, sort of thinking like the inability to think beyond the moment of the here and now. But there's something about that carelessness that is so, to me, American, but also so, in its own way, playful. It's beautiful and it's terrible at the same time, because it's like you don't care about the world. You don't care about things that are happening right now, or you don't care about certain things. That can be its own liberating or emancipatory practice, if you want to call it that, its own playful practice. Like, I don't care. I can just be myself, have fun. Who cares? Like, let's just experience the world, experience reality, do it you and I together. Just have fun and enjoy it like that. That could be one form of love. Mm-hmm. But it's also a sort of, you don't care. Like, you don't care about the emotions I'm putting into this, or you don't care about these other situations in our lives that are affecting us, or you don't care about, I don't know, the climate, like the things in a broader political sense, or war and genocide or things like that, right? It's like you don't care. There is a violence to that not caring.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want to use the word apathy. I didn't want to use the word indifference. Carelessness is interesting to me. It instantiates that there was care to begin with, but now it's lessened or now it's not there or whatever that case looks like. But kind of as a choice, I don't know what to do with that. So that's why there's this whole string of like, well, what is this carelessness? It's violent. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I'm glad that you made that distinction for me, because one thing I was actually going to ask you was, you know, do you think that carelessness and apathy are, they kind of mean the same thing? But I feel like you made a really good distinction, because to be apathetic kind of implies that you are not at fault. But I guess here with your word careless and, you know, implying that there was care to begin with, but now there isn't, that was a choice on their part. So do you think that to be careless is an active choice?
I think in some cases, yes. And I think in some cases, honestly, it can be an act of survival. If we cared about everything that was happening in the world, to ourselves, to our loved ones, to the people who are not our loved ones, but that we care about, what would we do? You know, where would we go? It's a cognitive overload as mm-hmm. human beings. Not to say that we can't care about certain things, but it is a sort of choosing what to care about. And in this moment, I would suggest that this person I'm writing about just chooses not to care about the intentions of where the love I'm giving is coming from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And part of the struggle for me, and to take it back to that micro or interpersonal level, is like I'm trying to work through these really difficult emotions of like how I see you as best friend, as lover, as all, you know, all these different mm-hmm. ways, right? And you're not really helping me out here. Like, you're not mm-hmm. giving me any, like feedback or, mm-hmm. or like, material to work with, if you want to put it that way. You know, that person will never care to care in that way. But maybe that's a beautiful thing. Maybe that's actually why our relationship works. Because if you critically interrogate that, you would kind of just be end in nowhere, maybe. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not sure if you can ever find a conclusion.
Is this, like, a classic case of the friend zone, in a way?
Maybe, but in an interesting way. I wouldn't say that we're in like a friend mm-hmm. zone. That's the nebulous space mm-hmm. of whatever, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. why it's like, well, do we really care to have a label for that or to interrogate the category? Like, you know,
interesting.
What if you just experience it?
Again, going back to this theme of vulnerability when you're loving someone, a conversation that we had prior to recording, we were talking about how to live necessitates a state of precarity. This is just a note that I wrote down.
That's a heavy note.
Yeah. What I meant when I wrote down this note when we last spoke was, you know, whether it's worth it to dive into things like love, knowing that we are going to get hurt, knowing that we are going to be in this vulnerable space. And I want to hear your thoughts on this very heavy topic.
The shorthand answer I have is emphatically yes, it's worth it. It will lead you to crazy, crazy stories. Crazy, beautiful, violent, what else did I say? Hopeless, unabashed, unwitting, horrifying stories. Mm-hmm. It's going to be so worth it. It's going to be so great. If you step back and try to unpack that or just entangle that, oh my gosh, it sucks. You know what I mean? But I think your note, is pertinent. Precarity, our lives are built on precarity in all its different ways. Whether that be interpersonally, we are made vulnerable to... just in a biological sense, to our parents, to the people who raise us, who nurture us in that way. Like as a baby, as a child, this is like going to kind of psychoanalytic territory, but we are made, we are always vulnerable, right? And we necessitate protection and care, right? I think you learn so much about yourself when you're vulnerable because you're forced to grapple with the reality that you are not omnipotent and you're not, you know, a sort of indestructible, whole self. You realize mm-hmm. that there are sort of this you want to put it this way, kind of falling apart a little bit. Like you have to see yourself in these different tones and registers when you mm-hmm. choose to love someone and when someone loves you.
Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed listening to you talk about these two poems, and I know that this is just kind of a brief snapshot of you as an author, but I'm just wondering if, you know, are there any other parts of your writing or your work that we haven't talked about here that give a full picture of you as an author?
So let's think about the terrain we covered. We talked about lightness, we talked about darkness, we talked about love, whether we should love. No, I'm kidding. I guess the only other thing that I try to play with or think through in my poems, especially recently, is temporality or time. Mm-hmm. And I think we did cover that, though, with the idea of memory. But just to maybe kind of put a canvas on that or to wrap that discussion up, I think... poetry is interesting because as it is recited, it is a sort of instantaneous thing, like the auditory aspect of it or even reading is an instantaneous thing. But the creation of a poem or the creation of a piece of writing is a long, drawn-out process of remembering, of thinking, of trying to interpret and disambiguate or maybe even ambiguate with different words and language and whatnot. And so I'm thinking about the time space of like really language or thinking.
Are you a writer?
Listener?
Dreamer?
Music nerd?
Want to cover artists?
Visit venues?
Write something?
Events?
Personal essays?
Anything. anything.
Submit to Discorder Magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
and Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder Magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show, or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
Yeah, I guess as we're kind of talking about, you know, your future directions as an author, I'm wondering if, you know, if you're working on anything right now, and if you have anything in the works. Yeah.
Yeah, well, American Summer and several other poems in that same vein are being collected, if you want to call it that way. Hoping to put something together. So all these books have been self-published. I'm wondering if I want to pursue traditional publishing. It's been really a joy to share it with you.
Yeah.
Just as a friend, but mm-hmm. also with folks on the waves, the airwaves, as yes. you want to call it.
No,
that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So after you've read all your beautiful poetry, I'm wondering, where can our listeners find your work? Where can they support you?
Well, everything is self-published on Amazon right now. I do have an Instagram. I don't really post on it. But if any updates were to happen, they would be posted there in the near or long-term future. For folks at UBC who happen to be in English and or geography or just see me around campus, if you know who I am, come say hi and talk to me. I think that's the best way of going through or sharing these types of thoughts and poetry. So,
for our listeners, I would encourage you to go on Amazon and look up Midnight Oil, Forever Last, From the Path Already Taken, and Angel in the Night, because I truly do love your work. So I guess my last question for you would be, as the show implies, cool kids. What makes you a cool kid? Big question.
Another big question. And in our pre-rehearsal practice rooms of this question, I did mention that part of it was because I'm friends with you. And I do want to instantiate that and make that clear.
Aww.
I really appreciate your opinion. I appreciate the work you're doing. It means I'm doing something right. To take it in a more self or introspective register, I think part of what makes me quote-unquote cool, which is interesting because I actually don't think it makes me cool insofar as, like, you know, the glasses kind of emoji cool, but this is what makes me different. It's my sensitivity. I think I learned that from my parents a lot. I think that's really what inspires the poems I write and the way that I interact with people and humans. Another way of saying that is that I care, and I care a lot about things. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to care about everything, but I care about other people. I care about how they feel. I care about what they're thinking, why they're thinking it, more so than what they're thinking and how they're thinking through it. And I seem to be, like, my biggest weakness and my biggest blessing, I think, is being able to be sensitive towards how people are. And that translates to observation, that translates to this messy writing that we've encountered here on this show. But I think the world would be maybe a little bit more cool if people cared then, or if people let themselves be sensitive. Because sensitivity involves that precarity, that vulnerability of, like, I have to expose myself to things in order to really feel them or to really understand them.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken me in a lot of different directions in my life so far, and it's probably going to take me through the ringer again, so on and so forth. But if there's anything that makes me quote unquote cool, I hope it's that. I hope it's that people know I care about them.
That definitely makes you a cool kid. I really enjoyed reading your work, and thanks so much for telling me about what makes you a cool kid to have on the show. I really appreciated you having you as a guest.
The pleasure is all mine, Elise. Thank you.
I just want to let you know that you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. That was the show Cool Kids, hosted by me, Elise Roy, and I just had a conversation with my lovely friend, Matthew. Thanks so much. I'll see you next time. We'll be right back.
personality is like an old jacket, coming apart at the seams. Now it looks like staying covered is a real struggle, coming apart at the seams. It used to be fashionable, it was top of the line, but its colors have faded, yeah, they have faded with time. And it doesn't keep out the rain like it used to. You wore yourself out in an endless racket, coming apart at the seams. And you're trying to be kind, but you just can't hack it. Got jaded in time, and you just can't keep out the rain like you used to.
Na 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 na.
Shelter that became your shackles, coming apart at the seams. And playing it safe won't help you win this battle, coming apart at the seams. On the sunny side of emptiness, what are you hiding in there? It's time to attempt this, time to lay ourselves bare, 'cause it doesn't keep out the rain like it used to. And you know what you want, let the rain seduce you. Yeah, you just can't keep out the rain like you used to. Yeah, you know that you want it, let the rain.
Hello, this is Tony Bardock of the Little Guitar Arming, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.